At the progress.
At progress, yeah. How were you doing at the shop with Sophie? What kind of wages were you making, and were you working full time?
I was working full time. I was getting $10 a week. At the book bindery, I was getting $6.50. In those days, that was supposed to be a lot of money, you know.
Uh-huh.
Rents were only $30 a month. Yeah. So,
was that a real small shop there?
When I was working with Sophie, yeah, it was a small place.
Was it in the neighborhood, or?
No, it was on Jackson and they call it Wacker Drive now. Jackson and Market. Yes. It was on Jackson and Market. That's where all the lady garment workers center was, around there. See, in the tailor shops, as far as tailor shops were concerned, I only know of three in the vicinity where I worked at the Progress, around Welch and Harrison there. And that was a Royal Tailor, Shapiro and Progress. And there was one across the street, a very small place. It was more or less a contracting shop. I can't think of the name of it to save my soul. In fact, when I learned to become a buttonhole maker, I was sent over there to help them out one time. You know, they needed a buttonhole maker.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually a lining maker. But my girlfriend was a buttonhole maker. And when we were slack, you know, during the slack season, I used to go home at noon, naturally, when I was a lining maker, I used to get to work first, right from the cutting room. So we used to get through right away and could go home. And this friend of mine, a Polish girl by the name of Clara, she was a buttonhole maker, and she used to get to work at the tail end when the coat was all finished, and, you know, then they had to put the buttonholes in, and I'll put the buttons on. So she always had to stay a little later. So in order for her to get through early enough for us to go downtown and go to State Lake or someplace, you know, go to the show, so I used to go over and help her. And that's how I learned how to make buttonholes. I wouldn't get paid for it. I was just helping her so she could get through sooner, you know.
What were the different operations that you learned, and where did you learn them? You hand sewed at home, right? So when you went to work with
Shapiro,
Sophie,
I was hand sewing. I was sewing snappers on skirts. They didn't have the zippers at that time. They used to put snaps on. Then when I started for Shapiro, he put me basting the four part, which is, you know, the facing of the coat onto the coat itself. Base that by hand, just give it four big bases or five, you know. And then it went to the operator, machine operator, and they used to stitch the edges with the tape so that when they turn it around, it would have a nice edging, you know. And then the edge stitchers would stitch the edging around. Well, when they put me on machine, I started as a lining maker. From there, I went to lapel padding, and I did collar padding, and I worked on so many different operations. The only operation I never worked on, as far as the men's coat, I never worked on pants except for a half a day that I was cleaning threads off.
The first day at Shapiro's,
yeah, at
right?
Shapiro's.
The rest of the time
day,
you were in the coat shop.
I always worked in the coat shop. And so I worked on everything but sleeves. I never had anything to do with the sleeve, the coat, or the pockets. I never put in pockets. But I did work on the welts, which is the little pocket up here, I mean, so. And every other operation I think I did of a coat. But sleeves, pockets, and I never was a canvas baster. You know what a canvas baster is? Well, underneath the front of a man's coat, they have a canvas that they put underneath there, and they lay the part and they baste it, you know, here or there. They have a machine, they call it a jumping machine, that bastes it on there so that when the lapel padder pads the lapels, which is a blind stitch, you only catch with the needle a couple of threads. It makes like a chain stitch. Haven't you ever gone through a clothing shop? You should.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And so that stiffening gives it the shape of the, you know, the front, you know, it keeps it in shape. And then they, over here, like on the edge here, they sew a tape. You know? And so then when the lining covers all that, see, then when the basting pullers, cleaners, they pull all these bastings out. But that part that they fell here, and different parts there, holds that canvas in place. See? And then, of course, the edging is stitched on to the front all the way around, you know. And that's why the men's lapels are nice.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That's what they call canvas base. That I never did either. I never worked on one of those jumping machines. They got a thick needle, and the jumps like this, you know.
Marie, what did you think were the better jobs?
Well, pocket making and sleeve sewing. People that sew the sleeve onto the coat, that's considered, in fact, it's supposed to be such a particular job that I wouldn't want it even if they offered it to me. See, because if the sleeve don't hang just right, it spoils the whole effect of the coat. That was considered a good job, and pocket making was considered a good job. And in those days, but I mean, there's so many good jobs as far as the coat is concerned.
I was curious.
See, now my last job that I had, I thought that was a good job because it was easy. I mean, it's...
I was going to ask you what other kind of considerations there were besides money, because I remember you telling me that one story of whether you were going to decide to be a pocket maker and a lining mm-hmm. maker, and the pocket making was harder in some ways, so you chose the other. You mm-hmm. know, what other kinds of considerations there were besides the piece rate that was paying?
Well, I mean, as far as lining making is concerned, you could make good money on linings too. It all depends how fast you were and how good. See, now, I was always considered a pretty good worker because I don't want to throw bouquets at myself, but I'm a perfectionist. I'll make something, a little pair of slacks for a two-year-old that maybe my niece changes her two, three times a day, you know, and they're in the wash. And everything has to be just so. If it's got stripes, they got to match. You know, my niece tells me, Auntie, what are you so fussy? She's only going to wear them around the house. I don't like to see anything made just any old way, you know. In fact, I went to work to help out in the small shop one time when they were very busy and they needed a lining maker. And when I saw the work that they were turning out there, of course, the place was supposed to be known as an overall shop, they used to call it, you know. I won't mention the name of the place, although they're out of business already. But when I went there and I saw the way they were making the pockets of the linings and the way they were sewing the labels down, they didn't change colors or anything, or colored thread for the different color linings. I says, my God, and they told me I was a little too particular. They says, what are you being so fussy about? Just shoot them out, you know. I says, if I was to make work like that at my place, I says, my boss would throw me out on my ear. I said, I can't work that way. I says, I'm not used to it, you know.
Was an overall shop a
they used to call it an overall shop because they made work for, you know, like for Montgomery Ward's, you know, the catalog stuff for Sears robots that you...
Was that a comment on the quality of it? Is that
well, that was between people that didn't work there. They used to say, I don't want to mention the name of the place.
Okay.
They make overalls over there. They don't make men's clothing, you know.
Yeah.
In other words, it was not a high-class place to work in. See, like, now take C.B. Shane. When I worked there, they used to make they didn't make suits there. We were a top coat and overcoat shop at C.B. Shane. And my boss was the originator of the season skipper. I don't know if you ever heard of the season skipper coat. Well, it was a man's coat, gabardine coat with an inner lining that had a sleeve. But the way he had that sleeve in, it wasn't binding or anything. See, where some people made the coat with an inner lining, but they used to sew the sleeve into the inner lining, and when the man put the coat on, he used to bind. Well, he had a certain way, it was open under here and up here someplace, where they had elbow room, in other words. And they used to call it the season skipper, because you could wear the coat all season long, you know, like in the fall, spring and the fall, and even in the winter time if you had the inner lining. And he had a patent on this coat. In fact, when Hartshaft and Marx started making the coat and they wanted to make it like C.D. Shane was, they came over there to learn how, they sent somebody over there, you know, the quality man and a couple other guys over to learn how the thing was made, and they were paying my boss a royalty, you know. Mm-hmm. For every coat that Hartz or anybody else made, like C.D. Shane used to make, he was getting, I think, $1.50 at that time.
Wow.
See? So, and we made, we didn't make any suits there at all. It was just top coats and overcoats that we made at C.D. Shane.
Let's see. You went to... You went to work at Ed Shapiro's in 1919, is that right?
No, before that. I started the tailor shop in 1919. Oh, no. That was the 1919, yeah. Oh, I don't remember now if it was...
Oh, was that the progress?
No, that was when I joined the union, was in 1919. I had worked there about 3 or 4 months before... Progress bought them out. So it must have been part of 1918, I think.
You worked for Shapiro's for just a few months, and then Progress bought them out.
Progress bought them out, yeah, because he was an elderly man, and I guess he wanted to get out of the business. So the Progress, being in the same building, they bought him out, and so they took over the 3 floors then we had. So then from there, I guess, is when we moved to Harrison and Wells, where they had a bigger area. They had a big building there. In fact, the building is still there. I mean, from Wells and Harrison, we moved to Troop in Harrison. See, the building is still standing there. I don't know. I think... there was a tailor shop there now, if I'm not mistaken. Anyhow, it was almost a square block building here.
Were you satisfied, do you think, or what were your first impressions when you first started working in a tailor shop?
Well, I used to like to work. I used to have a lot of fun at work, so I used to enjoy work. I mean, I never resented working. It was just in later years when it got to be a chore, you know. The older I got, I guess. But I didn't know.
Were there any different appeals or things or things that you didn't like about working at Progress that compared to the bindery and working?
Well, working at the bindery was just something different to do, you know. There's something in there. I really didn't have to work at that time because my father was still living. I mean, I just wanted that. And he got my name spelled wrong over here.
I
spelled it with 2 T's instead of 1 T.
Uh-oh. Before the Progress was organized totally, you said that there were still some union people working in the shop. Did they ever approach you at all before?
No. It was partly organized, you know, but then in 1919, May the 2nd, they had a great big drive, and everybody had to join. But, you know, it was, some were organized and some weren't. It wasn't a closed shop, you know. So, and me being that I had just started there, I didn't know beans about it. In fact, I didn't even know there were some union people there, you know. The organizers start coming around and said, you all have to join the union. Well, I says, well, I don't know anything about unions. So we talked it over with the girls on the way home. And I said, are you girls going to join the union? They said, yes, we are. So Mother says, whatever Josephine and Margaret does, you do. So that's what I did. 70 cents a month, and I think, was it 70 cents or 90 cents to join, or 70 cents a month? I don't even remember, so long ago.
You were saying once that you were kind of a devil when you were a kid, and when anything happened, why the foreman
was always
got after you.
I was
what
always
kinds of
them.
Things were you up to, Marie, in the shop?
Well, I don't know. I was always a practical joker, I guess. I don't know. I just was full of the devil some way or other. I liked to have a lot of fun, you know. To me, working was just a good time, you know. I enjoyed the people I was with, and I used to like to sing a lot in those days. Of course, I had a pretty good voice then. Now I haven't got such a voice anymore. Too many cigarettes, and I guess that kind of helped out a little bit. When we had the choir, I used to be a soprano, and I don't think they'd even take me for an alto or bass.
Did Progress Taylor go out of business? Is that why you went to Shane's? Oh, they moved.
They moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana.
When exactly was that? Do you remember?
Okay, I don't remember exactly. I remember it was the first year that our choir sang on May 1st. We used to celebrate May 1st in those days. So we had the celebration here in the building. And that's when they were moving. And he came up to me and says, are you going on stage? What are you going to do for a living? I said, oh, I'm going to join the Grand Opera, you know. And he said, no, well, you mean it. Are you, what are you going to do for a living? Your place is moving. I said, you're kidding. They said, oh, no, we're not. They said, you go on Van Buren and troops there, and you see they're moving the machinery out. Sure enough, we took a walk over there because it was not too far from me. It was only about 3 blocks. They were moving the machinery out without giving us any notice or anything. And this, I think, was on a Friday, because Monday we found a notice in the mailbox. They had mailed us notices, but we didn't get them until Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And Monday everybody started coming to work that didn't know about it. Of course, we knew. The ones that belonged to the choir, because we were here that Friday. In fact, there was about 6 of us that worked with the Progress that belonged to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew about it, but people that didn't know all came to work like they did every morning, bringing their lunch and everything, and found us picketing out in front. So this is what happened. The place was moving out of town. So, and that was... Well, it was during the Depression, jobs were pretty damn hard to get. I was just lucky that Clara Leon needed a lining maker at C.B. Shane, so I was able to get in there. And being that I was active,
I was
one of the first ones.
Is that one of the reasons that you...
One of the first ones to get a job. Now, the same thing when when C.B. Shane went out of business. We didn't know that they... we knew he was going out of business, C.B. Shane, not going out of business. He had to sell the business because he died. And he only had 2 daughters. The 2 son-in-laws were not interested in the clothing. And his brothers, who worked for C.B. Shane, one was the head of the office, and the other one had charge of the stock room, the shipping room. And the other one used to be on the road most of the time. But I guess they weren't too interested in the business. They only worked there on account of their brother. So the place was sold to Joseph and Feist from Cleveland. And they used to send the work from Cleveland here to Chicago for us to make, and then it would be shipped back to Cleveland. See? Well, that went on for a little while, and a lot of times we'd come down to work. The truck wasn't there from Cleveland with the work. We had nothing to do. We'd have to turn around and go home again. Well, I was a cheerleader there at the time, and people were complaining. were coming down to work and no work and spending car fare for nothing. So that went on for, oh, less than a year. And they were negotiating about getting a place here in Chicago, all on one floor. See, in Cleveland, Silver and Fife is supposed to be such a big building, but all their work is on one floor. See, where chains, we had four floors and part of another building. They had to break the wall and take part of another building where the butter sellers and the shipping department was. And so they didn't like the idea of all this running up and down and the work, you know, where in Cleveland, they had like a belt system, you know. The work could go from one department to the next and on to the next and all that, you know. They had more of a system there. I never saw the plant, but Clara Lena went over there and looked the plant over, see, after they bought Phoebe Sheen. And she was telling me about it. She says, Marie, you never seen anything like it. She says, well, the button sewers don't even have to get up from their chair to get the work, to put it on their lap and sew the buttons on. She says, they have like a rack of coats, and they have these chairs like on this rack with all their buttons and everything in front of them. And all they do is pull it off the rack onto their lap and sew it on, and it's still on the hanger, she said. They have a system there, she said, out of your foot. So I said, gee, I'd like to see the place sometime. She said, well, next time I go there, she says, I'll have you go along with me. Well, it didn't turn out that they could find a place that they wanted here in the city. So they decided they were going to make the work in Cleveland. So that left another 300, over 300 people out of work. So we didn't find that out until the joint board meeting night. See, Rose and I were both on the joint board. So we were here that night at the meeting when the manager announced it. That C.B. Shane, which was bought by Joseph and Fife, they decided that they were going to close the Chicago plant and make the work out in Cleveland. So that left us hole in the bag. So Rose and I said, well, looks like we're out again. See, she had left the pants shop to come and work at our place when we put in the button machine in order to break in some girls on the button machine. But she could always go back to the pants shop, you know, where I didn't have any place to go. So anyway, Benny Brenzo, Sal Brenzo's father, was head chairman of Hearts. So he used to always sit up in front. So on his way out after the meeting, he passed by where we were sitting, towards the back, and he says, Rose and Marie, Monday, this was on a Thursday, he says, Monday you come to Hartchester Marks, he says, and I'll see that you get a job. So he knew that we would be out of work.
What happened to, like when Progress went out of business and when Shane's went out of business, what happened to the other people that were suddenly out of a job that weren't quite so active?
Well, eventually they all came over here and registered. We had our employment office to be there where the retiree center is. They all came here and registered. And as they needed people in their line, you know, what they were capable of doing. See, when you register, you tell them, well, you're a lining maker, you can make buttonholes, you can do this or that or the other thing. So as they needed people, they utilized them.
Were those people getting paid anything to survive during that time? Or?
Well, we had unemployment insurance. See, of course, we were the first ones, the Amalgamated, started unemployment insurance, which was only $50, you know, from the beginning. And then when the government took it over, then, of course, you used to go and register that you were out of work, and after... I think it was a week. 1 week you had to be out, and then you start getting unemployment insurance, you know, in the meantime, which wasn't a heck of a lot, but it helped out some. See, I haven't applied for it for so many years that I don't even know what they get now. Mm-hmm. I think they're getting pretty good now.